Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by one of my regulars, that is Bill Galston of the Wall Street Journal and the Brookings Institution. Linda Chavez is under the weather today, so my Bulwark colleague Will Salatin is sitting in for her. Damon Linker is on vacation, so Chris Saliza is joining us in his place. Chris writes the Substack newsletter, So What?, which I highly recommend. And our special guest is Bulwark founder and publisher, Sarah Longwell. Also, Sarah, I think it's fair to say now you are a pundit extraordinaire. So we are delighted to have you all. And I thought we would start this week by talking about the biggest news, which is, of course, that like all of a sudden this news bursts that there are going to be two debates. And it all happened incredibly rapidly. It wasn't like one person proposing and another thinking, maybe I'll get back to it. No, it was like immediate. So the first thing that strikes me, and Sarah, I'm curious to see your reaction to this. First thing that strikes me is it's usually the person who's ahead who does not want to debate. But Trump seems to have jumped in here and agreed to all of Biden's terms, it seems. Did he get played? What do you think?
I'm not sure he got played. I think, look, Trump's whole thing is that he's going to wipe the floor with Biden. Biden's weak, got to be tough, tough, tough. And so the fact that Joe Biden was the one sort of throwing down the gauntlet, that was a clear move by Biden. I'm not sure if it was a direct reaction to another weekend of high profile bad polls, but it did feel like Biden's team wanted to get out and start shifting the narrative. And I don't think Trump's guys wanted to give an inch on that. There are a bunch of things strike me about the debate itself, things like there's not going to be an audience, which they both agreed to, which having seen the way that audiences can work in these, and it really we've seen them really help Trump in the past. That seems like a notable piece of art around how these are constructed.
Victory for Biden, I would say, that is.
I think so. I mean, it depends who the audience is. Like, if it was a bunch of people booing Trump. But, like, the audiences are terrible at these things anyway.
Yeah.
Like, let's, good, dispense with the audiences.
Yeah.
And so I was going, but the other thing that was super interesting is the date, right? So it's, I believe, June 27th. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Correct.
But that is nice and early. And I think that if I were the Biden team, I would be thinking, we got to have a dynamic shift in this race. And the best opportunity for that is potentially Trump gets a conviction in this Stormy Daniels trial. And then not too far after that, there is a debate. And like, Biden needs a B12 shot. He's got to go in there and show that he can handle Trump. And that is literally the only way you are going to shake this race out of its current stasis.
Yep. Will, the Trump people seem to have convinced themselves that Biden really is the senile, doddering man that they portray him as in all their ads, even to the point where they were apparently pressing that the debates should feature having to stand at podiums and not be able to sit because they think maybe Biden can't stand for 2 hours. So is that going to play to Biden's advantage? Because he is not, I mean, he is old and he looks, as somebody put it, he looks every one of his 81 years, but he is definitely not senile and not, you know, drooling. So what do you think?
Yeah. So I'm always tempted to infer what is the strategy behind a campaign's decision. But in this case, from the Trump campaign's perspective, I don't get it. I don't. And the reason is the simplest explanation for what Trump wanted here was that he thinks that because Biden is a bad speaker and Trump is a relatively good speaker, that a debate will serve him well. But the problem is that that's already the impression that everybody has. So there's nowhere to go but up for Biden by actually showing up. We saw this in the State of the Union. People were terrified. Biden's going to give a speech. Biden's a bad speaker. What happens? The expectations are so low that he overperforms. I just think the same thing's going to happen in the debate. I can't see the debate turning out so badly for Biden that it matches the low expectations that people already have for him. But this is, to Sarah's point, I don't recall, maybe you guys can correct me on this. Has there ever been a president, a general election? I mean, there won't even be nominations at this point, right? The conventions won't have been held.
That's right.
There's never been a debate this early. This is just bizarre, completely bizarre. And from, it makes no sense from Trump's perspective, but from Biden's perspective, for the reasons that Sarah outlined, it makes perfect sense. You have this stagnation in the race. Democrats thought they'd be doing better by now. They need to shake things up. What better way to do it than a debate? And the second one's over by the end of September. If something terrible happens, there's lots of time to recover. So I just think all of this plays out to Biden's advantage.
Yeah. I think the second one is scheduled for September 10th. So it would actually be over by mid-September. So Chris, one of the things that they both agreed to do is to ditch the debate commission.
Yes.
And just do this on their own. They agreed to CNN and ABC, which apparently has the people at Fox apoplectic. And they agreed no RFK Jr.
I feel like we should pour one out for the Commission on Presidential Debates.
You know, the late unlamented.
I can't remember if I wrote this or not, but like it was like one of the rare examples of like bipartisanship that still worked in Washington, right? You had like the former chair of the RNC and the former chair of the DNC were part of the Commission on the Presidential Debates. And every 4 years, they would sort of get together and pick the locations and pick the moderators. And it was like this. I did this yesterday. If you go to their website, it literally feels like it's 1989. Like the website may not have been updated since 1989. Like it was a little bit of an antiquated thing. I think it is now effectively over. You know, mm-hmm. I think of it in the same way that I think of when Barack Obama opted out of the public financing system in the 2008 campaign. You know, that sort of meant, well, that's that, right? Genie's out of the bottle. No one is going back into it. I think, Mona, the RFK Jr. piece is really interesting. I don't know if I smartly or dumbly, I agreed to a 30-minute Zoom call with anyone who becomes a paid subscriber to my newsletter, which was more people than I thought would want to do this. But what I will, just to be honest, but one person, these things are actually sort of interesting. And one person said, like, what's the most undercovered or misunderstood story out there, which is a good question. And I was thinking about it and I said, you know, I think it's actually RFK Jr., only in that, like, we still don't really know how many ballots he's going to be on. We still don't totally get, I mean, I know we can argue this, but totally get where his support is. Is he taking more from Trump, more from Biden, a little bit from both? We still don't totally get whether is he going to stay at 10 or 11% in a lot of these polls, or like a lot of third party candidates as the election gets closer, is he going to drop down? So to me, it seemed like a pretty obvious attempt by both Trump and Biden's people to get rid of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., at least in the debates. Now, he said on Twitter or X or whatever that he qualifies under the debate criteria. I don't think that's right. I mean, I would be stunned if he was on that stage. But it seemed to me that's one thing they agreed on was, okay, Robert F. Kennedy is sort of a free radical. We don't totally know what to make of him. So the best thing to do is try to cut him out of this process.
Right. And he is complaining that the two big campaigns colluded against him. And for once, I think he speaks truth.
Absolutely, you know, they did.
They did. Yeah. So, okay, fine. So, Bill, what Biden has needed to do was to focus people's minds on the choice, because as long as this campaign was perceived to be a referendum on him, he's losing. And so this really plays into his strategy. On the other hand, it is the case that if he has, you know, two or three senior moments during the debate, if he says something really outrageous, if something happens that is bad for him, we could be in a really desperate situation. So no pressure. But what do you think?
Well, the people who've spoken before me have made almost all of the smart points that it's possible in this universe to think of. So I will be brief. What I take away from this is, you know, an indication of just what each of these candidates thinks about the other. That's the only sense that I can make of it. You know, that Donald Trump genuinely believes what he and the people around him have been saying for months about Joe Biden. Because of that, they think they can't lose. Mm-hmm. And I will say that I've noticed that at about the 45-minute mark in a lot of events, Biden starts to tire visibly. You know, and there's, you know, the energy goes down, the clarity of the speech goes down, et cetera. And I think that they're betting that even if he starts strong, he can't sustain it. And they may turn out to be right. I don't know. On the Biden side, they are convinced that the man who came very close to discrediting himself completely in the first 2020 debate is the guy who's going to show up all over again. And so I think each one of the campaigns goes into this encounter with an enormous amount of confidence, and somebody has to be wrong.
I have one word for the Biden team: Ritalin.
Well, I would remind you, Mona, I would remind you that Donald Trump, without evidence, obviously, I think he was talking to Hugh Hewitt, directly suggested that Joe Biden had done cocaine before the State of the Union, which, again, just I know we've talked a billion times about how we moved, how the goalposts have been moved. But Can you imagine if can you imagine if Mitt Romney was the nominee and Mitt Romney was like, I think Joe Biden was on cocaine. I mean, it would be, people would be calling for him to drop out of the race within 10 minutes.
I know, it's true. And that is the weird Alice in Wonderland world in which we operate.
You know, I do think that there is another important thing for Biden, like in terms of the dynamic shifting. I assume that part of what the Biden team thinks is going to happen, and it's, I believe this is going to happen, or have long believed that one of the ways that this race starts to change is that Donald Trump becomes top of mind for people again. And once they start to look at him and are confronted with him, that they go, oh, yeah, I'm having weird delusions about his economy being so great, but that guy, do not care for him, don't want to vote for him again. The problem is that that is not happening yet, despite the fact that Trump is sort of giving these speeches, like the media is not covering him the way that they did in either 2016 or 2020 because he is in court. He is not campaigning in the court case for all the coverage that it gets is backward looking and about things people already know about Donald Trump. And so it's not about a forward looking, what is this guy going to do to our country? And so I think getting him on a debate stage sooner rather than later in the hopes of reminding people of what Donald Trump is like as a person is very important to their strategy, because they are counting not on building a pro-Joe Biden coalition, but on building an anti-Trump coalition. And that coalition's not coming together the way they want it to because of a variety of factors, from the fact that a lot of people are paying attention to what's going on college campuses and foreign policy, Israel-Palestine, and they're not paying attention to the fact that Donald Trump keeps at his rallies saying genuinely insane things that would alarm normal Americans who just frankly aren't paying attention right now, and they are desperate to get Americans paying attention to the choice in front of them.
Yeah, Biden is leading support among Black, Hispanic, and young voters. So some of the polls that have come out recently and that may have spurred this decision by Biden to rush into debates are pretty grim. Like in the New York Times, Siena poll showed Trump leading by 12 points in Nevada, by 10 in Georgia, and neck and neck in some other places. He was only ahead, the only swing state that he was ahead in, and again, by a margin of error, was Wisconsin. These are frightening. It's still early, but it isn't that early. And yet, one of the things that I would like to hear you all on is the way Biden, until this announcement of debates, but the way Biden has been handling the question of the economy, which is top of mind for voters, the thing they are most concerned about, the thing they are most angry with him about. He was asked about this on CNN by Erin Burnett, and let's just listen to her question and how he reacted.
So when you talk about the economy, of course, it is by far the most important issue for voters. It's also true right now, Mr. President, that voters by a wide margin trust Trump more on the economy. They say that in polls. And part of the reason for that may be the numbers, and you're aware of many of these, of course. The cost of buying a home in the United States is double what it was when you look at your monthly costs from before the pandemic. Real income, when you account for inflation, is actually down since you took office. Economic growth last week, far short of expectations. Consumer confidence, maybe no surprise, is near a two-year low. With less than 6 months to go to Election Day, are you worried that you're running out of time to turn that around?
We've already turned it around. Look at the Michigan survey. For 65% of American people think they're in good shape economically. They think the nation's not in good shape, but they're personally in good shape. The polling data has been wrong all along. You guys do a poll at CNN. How many folks you have to call to get one response?
Bill Galston, I'm going to start with you this time. So he says the polls are wrong. People don't appreciate all the wonderful things I've done. They're wrong about the state of the economy. Well, how do you react?
Well, there's that old line from Chico Marx, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? what can you say? Every fact that Aaron Burnett put on the table in that question is verifiably true. Mm-hmm. And, I have been tracking the real wages and real household incomes, on a weekly and a monthly basis. And people are exquisitely sensitive to changes in their purchasing power. That's just a fact. And that is particularly true for people in the working classes and lower middle classes whose budgets barely go far enough to cover the necessities. And so if they're not doing as well as they were a while back, that will show up in harder choices that they have to make. Which bills do you defer? Do you defer the credit card bill and pay 22% interest? Are you a little bit late with the rent, which is a bad idea? Do you cut back on the quality of food? Do you use electricity less? I mean, people like us don't have to make these choices. But, people with household incomes of $45,000 or $50,000 a year are making these choices every day. And I just think it's a bad idea to tell the American people you don't know what's really going on, right? You're just not paying attention. And if you paid attention to all the wonderful things I've did, you'd be feeling a lot better. I don't see how you can sell that any more than you could sell the same message with the headline or the package of Bidenomics, which was abandoned, but after being ridiculed to death. So I do not think that's a winning strategy for the president and his team. I would bet that they have told him it isn't. But he will not concede on that point. And he is a very proud and stubborn man. And I don't think his team is going to be able to talk him out of it, frankly.
Chris, you had a very notable reaction to that clip. Tell us what you think.
First of all, just from a strategic point of view, saying, what do you say to all these people who are struggling with, their day-to-day economic life? The answer of the polls are wrong is not an effective answer, just purely strategically. But it does make me insane, their argument. I mean, this is 13-year-old Chris losing tennis match after tennis match, which did happen, and blaming the racket and telling my parents, I just need the new, more expensive racket. The tendency, and it is rampant on the left, particularly the online left, and the Biden people seem to have glommed onto it, the tendency to say polling is wrong because it doesn't show what we want it to show, I think is very problematic, right? I don't think you have to look at just the Siena New York Times poll, right? Look at the 538 polling averages, just as an example, right? So a much broader swath of the polling. Donald Trump is ahead in, Joe Biden won six key swing states. Donald Trump is ahead at a minimum in three of them. The upper Midwest is more, by the way, those three are Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia. Sorry, I should have said that. Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, I think are broadly pretty close, basically tosses, but he's behind in those three. That's a problem, and it's not just a poll. It's not the poll's fault. The New York Times, I heard this a lot this week, the New York Times is just out to get Joe Biden. Come on, people. Listen to what you're saying. You know, I mean, like, I don't buy that the New York Times is some like giant liberal organization, but I also don't think that like their MO is to go get Joe Biden. So it bugs me. I think the Biden people complain a huge amount about the polling and the coverage. And I think the problem is their messaging. And they don't want to own up to that. And I think that's a problem. That's how they respond to everything. It's how they responded to the Times Siena polls. Well, these polls are wrong. If those polls were wrong, I will tell you, Sarah may disagree with me, but this is my view. If those polls were wrong and they had polling that had Joe Biden up 5 points in Nevada, they would release that poll and say, here it is. We told you it was wrong. They didn't. And not only that, he then pushed for debates 2 days later.
Yeah.
In my view, there are very few coincidences in politics, and this ain't one of them.
Yep. And Will Salatin, the polls have actually underreported Trump's support in the past, not overstated his support. I don't think there are any shy Biden voters out there who just don't want to admit that to pollsters. So it doesn't seem likely. And the other thing that's interesting about these polls, which again suggests that it's a Biden thing, is that some of the Democratic candidates for Senate races and so forth are outpolling Biden, right?
Right.
So it really is it's a wake-up call. It's a red siren, you know, it's a red light flashing, right?
Right. So look, these questions that we debate, we can speculate about them, but there's actual evidence that you can use to parse which hypothesis is true. And what we're seeing is evidence that the thesis that Joe Biden is a problem, is a bad candidate, that thesis is gaining credibility. So the New York Times Siena poll, there were four states in which they polled Biden and they polled the Democratic, the Senate candidates, right? Arizona, the Democratic Senate candidate, Ruben Gallego, up 4, Biden down 7. Nevada, Jackie Rosen up 2, Biden down 12. Pennsylvania, Bob Casey up 5, Biden down 3. Wisconsin, Tammy Baldwin's up 9, Biden's up 2, but that's still a 7-point gap. In state after state, I mean, this is like a 10-point average that Biden is underperforming. Now, you could say, we have amazing candidates for the Senate. But no, that's not what's going on. The simplest explanation is that there is a Biden problem. Good news for Democrats, not a Democratic problem. The bad news is this is something fundamental about this guy. And his response about the polls are wrong. First of all, every election I've ever seen, when the people who start saying the polls are wrong, that's always a sign of death.
They're losing.
Sometimes you may be right, but that's a stage of denial and of not facing up to the problem. So Biden is privately frustrated. But you don't say, when you're confronted with this evidence by Aaron Burnett, you don't say, the polls are wrong. I don't believe the polls. A good politician, one who can speak, says two things are true at the same time. Some things are not great, like what Bill was discussing. You have cost of living relative to costs, you know, your wages have not kept up, whatnot. All of this is true. You're squeezed. Butter is expensive, whatever. But at the same time, some things are getting better. I'm getting you $35 insulin. I'm getting you a cap on, you know, your medical spending. I'm doing things for you despite this. A good politician could say that. Joe Biden isn't saying it, and that is a fundamental problem. I don't think that's going to get better.
Okay, Sarah, feel free to comment on any of that, but then I have something else I want to get your input on.
Chris brought up, you know, the message is wrong, and this is like a classic messenger message combo problem. And I'll just combine Chris and Will's points here a little bit, which is Joe Biden and somebody who was capable of like really making an offensive argument would be like, listen, Donald Trump mishandled COVID and drove this economy into the ditch. America is recovering better than any other industrialized country coming out of COVID. When Donald Trump left office, we were locked in our houses still. We were still dealing with his horrible mishandling. And now look at our lives. We're all out. COVID's behind us and our economy is recovering. Is it there yet? It is not. You guys are still paying too much for butter. You are still getting squeezed on your rent. But you know what? You give me 4 more years and we're going to keep fixing this because we have been climbing our way out of it the way America does. Like anybody could handle this, right? It's just, it is right there to blame Donald Trump for it is. And like, it is frustrating to have a messenger not able to meet the urgency of the moment
And then to the campaign behind him understanding that they are dealing with a messenger who can't meet the urgency of the moment, trying to sort of give him a box he can live in that, like, so he doesn't get too all over the place. Like the idea of like just deny the polling. And I can just see, I mean, I talk to people all across the political spectrum, both the voters and people who are like thinking about these campaigns. And there's so much hand-wringing about the message. And the reason everybody hand-wrings about the message is because they're stressed about the messenger, right? They don't feel like he can carry the message. And that is why you need to say, okay, one of the things that's striking to me, Donald Trump is in court and he's got surrogates. He's under a gag order. So what do all the Republicans do? They run to the court to talk for him, to be his surrogates, to say how it's a two-tier justice system and it's a witch hunt and to go after everybody. The Speaker of the House is doing that for him. Joe Biden, not a great messenger. Let's just say he's got a actuarial gag order, okay? And so, like, if he has that, there should be 1,000 surrogates out there being his voice, pushing, blaming Trump for where things went, talking about how Biden's pulled us out of this, and you just don't have that. You don't have that echo chamber. And, like, to me, this is a solvable problem, and I don't know why it's not being solved. Like, Biden's messenger isn't a solvable problem, but the surrogate piece is.
Yeah. Okay, there's something else. So one of the things that I've been focused on as the primaries have played out is the number of so-called zombie votes for Nikki Haley that continue to rack up even after she pulled out of the race and there's, you know, she's no longer even a candidate, but she keeps getting roughly 20%, in some cases much higher. And, you know, I was tempted to say, This is great. This shows that there is a remnant of the Republican Party that is sending a message and saying, I'm going to drag myself out to the polls, even when I know there's no contest, just to send a message that I don't like Trump. And I thought that was good news for Biden and good news for the country. And then I read this piece in the New York Times that looked at zombie voting in all the previous races. And guess what? 20% is actually low compared to previous races. And they looked at it and their conclusion based on the analysis of people who study these things was that the share of voters supporting candidates who had already withdrawn remained relatively consistent even on the last day of primaries held before the party's conventions. And this is the money quote, there is no pattern linking the size of the zombie vote to the eventual nominee's chances of winning or losing in the general election. What do you think, Sarah?
The polls don't mean anything. That's just, I don't trust that. That's tough medicine, actually, yeah. Because I too have found comfort in the Haley vote. In fact, it's the only comfort I've found in any numbers that I've seen anywhere. And honestly, I'm not like whoever this political scientist who went back and dug through these numbers. I do find it pretty specific to Nikki Haley. I think part of the reason it feels so comforting is that Nikki Haley is such an avatar for a certain kind of Republican that we find persuadable. I know it is for us. Like we, in my like more activist side of work, Republican voters against Trump, like we are very focused on isolating people who voted for Haley in primaries. I will say, though, we've done a number of focus groups with Nikki Haley voters in primaries that were closed, and a lot of them are going home to Trump. Many of them talk about leaving it blank, which is, I would say, I've got like a very nascent theory that I won't let anybody hold me to. The number of people that I hear talk about leaving it blank this time who have voted for Trump twice, but they're like, I won't vote, like they won't vote for Biden. Like their level of persuadability on it is like, they're still just not voting for a Democrat, but there seem to be a lot of people who will turn out in their election and they're just going to leave it blank or they're like RFK curious at the moment. Look, the Nikki Haley people, some percentage were always going home. Some percentage already voted for Joe Biden and were turning up in the more open primaries. And then some of them are these double haters. Right? They don't like either party. And you sort of got to convince them to hate one guy more. And that's tough because they're temperamentally conservatives. And so, yeah, I'll take your word and the New York Times analysis word that's true. I still think that there's a persuadable bucket in there, in large part because I know for a fact the people who've been politically realigning and voting for Democrats over the last
cycles where Trump has been the nominee are sort of Haley-type Republicans. And so it's not crazy to think that this is a little bit of a different bag, but I don't have facts to bring to your data fight.
Yeah. Well, I do think it is possible that we are dealing with something new under the sun, though, in the case of Trump, exactly for the reason that you cited. Namely, we did see it both in 2020 and in 2022, we did see traditional Republican precincts voting against Trump, but voting for other Republicans down ballot. And that is something that you don't usually see in our time. And so, you know, I think some people have even said that had it not been for disaffected Republicans, Biden wouldn't be in the White House right now. So, I mean, it's not as if he pulled in a whole bunch of new Democratic voters. He didn't.
I just wanted to make one data point, which doesn't dispute in any way the Times analysis, but I do think adds to your maybe this time is different. I just think that we tend to forget how close a number of these swing states were in 2016 and 2020. I mean, I just spent time looking at this. I don't usually have these numbers at my command. But in 2016, Donald Trump won Wisconsin by, call it, 21,000 votes. In 2020, Joe Biden won Wisconsin by 20,000 votes. In 2020, Joe Biden won Arizona by 11,000 votes. He won Georgia by 11,000 votes. So to Sarah's point, like, let's assume Nikki Haley got 150,000 votes in Pennsylvania, give or take. Let's assume two-thirds of those people don't, right, just don't vote, right? Like, they either don't vote for Biden or they come home and vote for Trump. Like, she doesn't need Biden doesn't need that many votes, right? I think we're assuming, like, well, that this 150,000 are going to move en masse to Biden. No, they're absolutely not. He doesn't need them to. If 10% of them, and she's gotten 80 or 90,000 votes in most of these states, if 10% of them move, given what we expect in terms of the closeness, I mean, I assume it will be in these swing states pretty damn close, like, that can make a difference, right? I think that that's the key, is like, the we are talking about extremely, if 2016 and 2020 are a guide, I think they are, we're talking about extremely small margins in these swing states where 12,000 people doing something different than they did 4 years ago or 8 years ago can mean a different person wins the state.
Game of inches. Will, there was one other polling datum that was kind of interesting and possibly important for how the campaign continues to play out. Oh, and by the way, that is one other small ray of hope is that likely voters, and it may be too early to measure likely voters in May, but likely voters were better for Biden than registered voters. So there was that. But they were asked about what they remembered about Trump's term in office. Okay. And 39% said they remembered his conduct. Okay. 24% said they remembered his economy. 5% said they remembered the January 6th attempted coup. And 4% said COVID, which is really amazing. But those data might seem dismaying, except they could present an opportunity. I have heard that when people sort of test messages with voters, if they put January 6th footage front and center, this works better than almost anything to get people to, you know, reconsider their support for Trump. And if only 5% at the moment, if when you poll them, are saying they're thinking about that or they're remembering that, well, it can be put in front of their faces as the campaign goes on.
Yeah. So a couple of things. On those numbers you just read me, Mona, I think that was a large number about for conduct. Large number remembered Trump's conduct. Small number remembered January 6th. But I think a lot of people who would say January 6th would say conduct, and that would encompass all of the crazy behavior, including that. So
yeah,
it is probably used because of the severity of January 6th, because that was a threat to democracy and not just a mean tweet. It probably is useful to pull that out and say, let's focus. Remember the whole Steve Bannon strategy of just flood the zone, right? You got all this stuff going on. You need to highlight. We can't be saying everything Trump did is bad. It's true, but some were worse than others. So you pull out the January 6th stuff. I can see that as a point. The COVID number is incredibly frustrating, and it's an illustration of what we've been saying about a messenger driving a message. Donald Trump was out there every day saying, I did a great job. I built this great economy. And then the China virus came in. Suddenly, that's a completely different phase. I'm not responsible for it. You know, the fact that Donald Trump literally tried to prevent the government from testing people to find out how bad things were, and that he lied about the virus coming in and said the stock market is great, ignore this. I mean, so many unconscionable things. That's all wiped away because this is not Donald Trump's presidency. This is the year of the China virus. And bizarrely, the polling data seems to suggest that people are buying that. And this is not just this poll. I've seen multiple polls suggesting that. So it's going to be a challenge to get to override that, particularly with Joe Biden not being a good messenger. And I hear Sarah's point about getting surrogates out to drive the message. But I wonder if at this point, 4 years, 3 years later, if that isn't baked in, if it's going to be just too hard to change people's memories of that. Whereas January 6th, I feel like that's a singular episode that is clearly associated with Trump. You've got video of him calling out the crowd. And you've got a lot of evidence from the J6 committee. Maybe you can drive that message.
Okay, let us turn now to a few words from our sponsor, Babbel. What is the best way to learn a language? Well, it's immersion. Just go to a foreign country and live there, and you will pick it up very quickly. But if that's not possible, the next best way is with Babbel. 1 in 5 Americans have said that learning a new language is one of the things on their bucket list. And if they use Babbel, it's very easy. It's on your computer, and it is geared to both your audio and visual learning styles, and you can modify it. It has quick 10-minute lessons that are designed by over 150 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. And it is the kind of thing where if you are planning to go to a foreign country on vacation, or possibly to live for a little while, it gives you very practical, down-to-earth exchanges in the foreign language. They help you with your pronunciation, and they give you quick little quizzes that really cement your new knowledge, and then they build on it quickly so that you find yourself engaging in conversations pretty darn quickly. Now, here is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, you can get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners. You go to babbel.com/beg to differ. That's right, 55% off at babbel.com/beg to differ. And it is spelled BABBEL.com. Again, /beg to differ. Rules and restrictions apply, and we thank them for sponsoring Beg to Differ. All right. There was a Maryland primary this week, potentially quite important for the makeup of the Senate, because Maryland, which is normally a blue, blue, blue state, now is going to have a contest between Larry Hogan, who is an incredibly, was a very successful and very popular Republican governor, who just got the Republican nod to run for Senate, and Angela Alsobrooks, the Democrat. I'm going to turn to you, Sarah, and ask you for the significance of this. Does this mean, for one thing, that Democrats are going to have to spend money in a state that they normally can take for granted, and therefore deprive other states that are going to be close races this year of funds? Or what's your sense of the importance of Maryland?
100% that Democrats are going to have to spend money in Maryland. I mean, Larry Hogan is not a shoe-in for this Senate seat. I think there are a lot of Maryland voters. I actually just did a focus group. There's an episode of the Focus Group podcast with Michael Steele where we talked to Hogan-Biden voters. And so these were pretty moderate Democrats. They loved them, some Larry Hogan. And a lot of them were interested in voting for him. And I think, you know, there's a chance that he could pick it up. Maryland is a pretty blue state. It is a pretty blue state. And I think that their calculation of, do we want to give, the ads are all going to say one thing. Do you want to give Donald Trump another Republican Senate seat? And like, they won't go as far to say this, but they might as well say, Hogan's a nice guy. He was a fine governor. You liked him. But we're not really giving Trump another Senate seat, right? And like, that's going to be the message. I will say there was a lot in this group of frustration with Angela Alsobrooks from sort of the moderate Dems. I got a little tripped up at doing my own focus groups with these super moderate slice of voters because they were so down on her that I was like a little surprised that there was such a blowout. But I do think that Maryland is a deeper shade of blue. And that's why I think it's a tough haul for Hogan, but they're going to be nervous enough about Hogan that they're going to spend money there. The Democrats are.
Bill, 30% of the electorate in Maryland is African-American. She'd be the first African-American senator from Maryland, period, and also the first woman. Do you think, looking back now, that it turned out best for Democrats, that it's she who's the nominee and not Trone, who outspent her like 9-1? He spent more money than anyone has ever spent in a Senate primary, like $61 million of his own money. Thank you, Total Wine and more. But but he lost.
Yes, he did lose. He started out way ahead. And I was one of the consumers, not so much of his slick TV ads, but every 5 days or so, I got another very substantive and well-produced brochure. You know, here's what I did on X, here's what I did on Y, here's what I did on Z. He didn't go negative until the last 2 weeks of the campaign. And I think most people receiving that stuff would get an impression of a David Trone who was moderately progressive, you know, quite substantive, knowledgeable about national issues. And he seemed like a strong candidate to me. And I can tell you that people who, because I've gotten this firsthand, people who gathered at the Alsobrooks party on election night were expecting to stay up until 3 a.m. They all thought it was going to be a cliffhanger. When she won by 13 points, they were gobsmacked, absolutely gobsmacked. And we're talking about senior Maryland politicians who know the state, you know, like the back of their hand. Let me tell you what I think happened and why, you know, I agree with everything that Sarah said, but she may turn out to be a stronger candidate than a lot of people expect. There was an ad towards the end of the campaign, a Trone ad, where one of his supporters says, if she gets to the Senate, she's going to need training wheels. Within 24 hours, 800 African-American women had formed a network of people who were just berserkal mad, you know, that at the suggestion that someone who sort of, you know, demonstrated her chops as a, you know, Prince George's County executive, which is a tough, tough county to be executive of, would be accused of somehow not being competent. That's the way they heard that. And the most effective political network in the Democratic Party, namely African-American women, went into fifth gear. And I'm convinced that this massive, angry mobilization the last 2 weeks of the campaign had a lot to do with her margin of victory. Why am I making these Maryland-specific points? Answer, because I think there's going to be a lot of national excitement in certain parts of the Democratic Party who haven't had a lot to be excited about, starting with African-Americans, that of the prospect at sending a history maker to the Senate, not only depriving the Republicans of another seat, but adding a new kind of voice from Maryland to the U.S. Senate. And Democrats will have to spend money, but you know what? They're not going to be short of money. That's the only thing they're not short of right now. And I don't think it's going to be a problem for the overall Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. So I am very, very worried, as a lot of people are, about her ability to be competitive in the more rural and conservative Democratic areas of Maryland. And I bet Sarah was picking up a lot of that in her focus groups. But there's another side to this story, namely excitement and mobilization that really showed itself in the last 2 weeks of the campaign, and I think will probably continue.
Chris, I have very mixed feelings about Larry Hogan. You know, he's the kind of Republican that we would like to see more of. He never did cave to Trump. Sarah tried to recruit him even to run against Trump, unfortunately, unsuccessfully. He's one of the last, frankly, of the Republicans that you can admire and think well of these days. But the reality is that, at least for me, I have to root against him because I don't want the Republicans to get the Senate, you know, and it's a weird place to be. But because of the nature of the rest of the party, I find myself feeling like, well, you know, it's a shame because Larry's great. But, you know, if there were 30 Larrys in the Senate, it would be different.
Right. I think you, Mona, hit on something that I think is really important. And I think there's people just need to understand there's a huge difference between state elections, like a governor's race, and federal elections, like a Senate race. So in a state election, you can wind up with a Republican governor of Massachusetts or a Democratic governor of Kansas, right? Or even a Democratic governor of Wyoming. Dave Freudenthal got elected to two terms as the governor of Wyoming as a Democrat. It's way harder, even if you're super popular, to get elected in a federal race if you are of the party that is not the dominant party in the state. I thought of two off the top of my head I was just thinking of. One is Steve Bullock, who is the governor of Montana. He ran in 2020. He was supposed to be, you know, he was a popular governor, a plain state governor, you know, a guy who could appeal to the center. He had been elected twice. He got killed by Steve Daines, just a sort of down-the-line Republican. Phil Bredesen, who was, you know, people talked about him running for president. He was a moderate, had done a ton of stuff with healthcare in Tennessee, two-term governor, Democratic governor of Tennessee. He runs, I think it was 2018, he gets killed. So I just think when you talk about federal races, they are way more partisan. It is way harder to get away from your national party. And so while I think Larry Hogan is without question the strongest candidate Republicans could nominate, I'm guessing in a presidential year turnout, it's also Brooks 54, Hogan 46. Like I just struggle to, which honestly takes nothing away from Larry Hogan. I don't think any other Republican in that state could get 46. It's just people think of federal officials differently. It's so much easier to be tied to the unpopular figures in your national party, like Donald Trump, who, by the way, is going to get 38% in, you know, in Maryland. Is Larry Hogan really going to overperform the top of the ticket by 13, 14 points? That's really, really hard. Which, by the way, I'll just note, is my argument against John Tester in Montana, the Democrat, and Sherrod Brown in Ohio. Those are both states that Donald Trump's going to win by somewhere between 8 and 15 points. No matter how good John Tester and Sherrod Brown are, it is difficult to overperform the top of the ticket by that much.
Yeah. Well, Hogan is already being asked about where he would come down on questions like a national abortion ban. And, you know, he has said, I would not vote for that. Question, would that really be effective if he is part of the Republican caucus? And he and his opponent, also Brooks, is going to be running ads saying, you know, if he's the senator, then they'll have that kind of thing could come up. Whereas it couldn't if the Democrats are in charge.
Okay, so I am super excited to talk about this. I'll try to do this quickly. First of all, super excited that a guy who spent $60 million to just try to bombard us with, you know, a bunch of, as Bill said, I got the same mailers. I mean, it was everywhere you look, TV, video, on the internet, David Trone. And it was exasperating to me that he spent all this money to jack up his name ID and then use the name ID as reflected in polls to say, only I can beat Larry Hogan. I think that's bull. I think also Brooks is going to beat Larry Hogan. And one reason why I think she's going to beat Larry Hogan is for some of the reasons that we've just been talking about. Usually we just sit around here and talk about voters and we're guessing or we have them in on a focus group or a poll. I get to be a voter today. I'm a Maryland suburban voter. I voted for Larry Hogan in 2018 for governor. There's not a chance in the world that I'm going to vote for this guy against Alsa Brooks. First of all, I did not know much about her, but I read the Washington Post coverage of her, that she's actually a pragmatist. You know, she resisted the left on curfews, on pulling school resource officers, police out of schools. There's a bunch of things where she didn't do what the left wanted her to do.
She's a former prosecutor, right?
She is. She's going to be fine. She's going to be absolutely fine. And to this point about Larry Hogan, there are some competing schools of thought among us sort of never Trump or like moderate people about how to deal with the Republican Party, in particular, someone like Larry Hogan, the good Republican. What do we do with this guy? We would like to elect good Republicans, right? I voted for him, the good Republican, as governor. In this context of him going into the Senate and being the 50th or 51st member of a Republican majority with Donald Trump waiting in the wings, even if Donald Trump doesn't get elected, Mitch McConnell is being shoved out, partly because he's old, but partly because, you know, the Trumpists don't like McConnell. I just see this increasingly Trumpy congressional GOP. There's not a chance in the world I'm going to give them another vote. Not a chance. So I think Alsobrooks Brooks is going to clean them. It's going to be, as somebody said, 54-46. Yeah, it's going to be like an 8-10 point race because people like me are going to vote for her and not for him.
Excellent.
It might seem like the 2024 U.S. presidential election is happening in a vacuum, but it will have global repercussions.
All of America's allies are thinking very, very hard about how they should reconfigure themselves in case an isolationist president is in the White House.
Swamp Notes from the Financial Times brings you insights on the race through an international lens. You can listen to Swamp Notes on the FT News Briefing podcast every Saturday.
Okay, and we'll turn now to our highlight or lowlight of the week. And Chris Saliza, I'm going to start with you.
Thank you. Okay, so my highlight, and we mentioned it briefly, but I want to mention it somewhat less briefly. No live audience at the CNN debate. I cannot celebrate this enough. Live audiences have been ruining political debates for as long as I have been watching political debates. I think it is particularly toxic in a presidential debate. So I just went back and looked. 73 million people watched the 2020, the first debate, Trump versus Biden. And by the way, that was far lower than watched the first debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in 2016. But let's just say it's 73 million. How many people can fit in any one auditorium in random state that they choose to hold it? Let's say it's 5,000, though I doubt it's that. Why should 5,000 people who don't follow the rules, who clap and boo, because the rules always say, please hold your applause,
yeah, right,
please
right.
don't interrupt, blah, blah. Why should those people impact how the 72.95 million people watching it on TV feel about the race? And you can say, well, I don't care about what the live audience does, but I can assure you human nature is such that if Joe Biden makes a point and there's like uproarious applause, you will be like, that was a pretty good point. Like, it's just human nature. It's just who we are. So thank you, CNN, ABC, please follow the lead. No live audiences. It drives me insane. I love that we're not doing it.
Amen, brother. Okay, Bill Galston.
Well, I have a highly visible lowlight and a much less visible highlight. My highly visible lowlight is the catastrophe that's occurring on the battle on the Russia-Ukraine, battle line, where the Russians are pushing forward on multiple fronts. The Ukrainians are desperately trying to patch the holes in their defense. There is one reason and one reason only why this is happening, and it is the unconscionable six-month delay inflicted by House Republicans principally on the renewed shipment of arms to Ukraine. This is one of the most shameful periods in the history of the U.S. Congress. And if anybody thinks that this horseplay that's going on for purely political purposes doesn't have real-world consequences, just look at the reports from the battlefield. I don't get angry about a whole lot of things, but I am really angry about this one because people are dying, and Ukraine could lose the war because of this delay. Grr. Okay, the less visible highlight was a piece in the Washington Monthly that I saw recently by Colin Woodard, who has put together an effort to try to figure out whether there is an honorable and workable national consensus that we might be able to build on to tamp down some of this horrible polarization. And he and in an institute he helped start have been doing some research. And guess what? In a bunch of test questions, the tradition started by the Declaration of Independence wins over various forms of ethno-nationalism and wins big. I have long believed that if we were ever going to get back together again, it would have to be on the basis of our founding principles. And now Woodard has developed some pretty compelling evidence that that may just be true. So I'm really bummed out in the short term, but I'm not without hope for the recovery of comedy in our nation's politics in the longer term. If suddenly someone figures out how to turn the Declaration of Independence message into something that actually makes sense to the American people right now. And I do not think that that would be mission impossible.
Okay, Will Salatin.
So a couple of things. One is, I want to give a shout out, these are lowlights, to Nicole Shanahan, RFK's running mate, completely a person with no political experience at all, a sort of vaccine injury curious, you know, quack, who RFK's running mate, whose sole qualification is her wealth. And RFK Jr. is running a populist, anti-elitist campaign about like the rich, powerful interests controlling your life. His campaign is funded by his vice president. She just chipped in another $8 million to their campaign. This is a woman who maxed out legally at $6,600 last year. But because he put her on the ticket, she gets to pump another $8 million and bringing her total to his campaign and the super PAC to $14 million, I believe, at this point. So it's just an illustration of how, like, as with Donald Trump, people who tell you that like the rich are controlling your life are actually the rich people trying to engineer their way into office. One other thing I want to shout out as a lowlight, J.D. Vance, Mike Lee, Ron Johnson, these isolationist senators in the Republican Party, they voted against the package to give aid to Israel and Ukraine and Taiwan. And then they have the gall when Joe Biden comes out and says he's going to restrict one kind of bomb, a 2,000-pound bomb to Israel to do one operation in Rafah. They have the gall to come out and attack him from the right and accuse him of being soft and on protecting America's allies when they, the isolationists, voted against all the money to begin with. It's disgusting.
Thank you. Okay, Sarah Longwell.
Good ones, Will. I have a debate one too, which is Biden going around the commission on presidential debates and effectively killing them is a really good thing. This is not one of those norms we need to preserve. They've been around since like 1987, hasn't been that long, and it's been terrible. Just been last time they basically let Trump almost give Biden COVID because they were so bad in enforcing the rules. The audience is like, good riddance, forget it, don't need it. That's my highlight. My low light is, just since we're talking about good Republicans that I love but feel conflicted about every now and again, love me some Mitt Romney. He's great. But he did this weird thing where he came out and said that Biden should definitely have pardoned Trump on the Stormy Daniels stuff, that he just should have pardoned. And I think he was talking about generally should have pardoned Trump on these cases. And that is bananas to me. Like, what do you mean he should be pardoning Trump? Like, if Trump's convicted and Biden wins and Biden wants to pardon him then after he's been held accountable and he's not in a position to run the country again, or if Biden was going to pardon him in exchange for Trump saying he would not pursue political office anymore, maybe. But just like demanding that Biden pardon Trump, what are we talking? I get Mitt Romney, you are a nice man. I know you're a nice man. You want people to do good, noble things. But the idea that Biden should be pardoning Trump right now is ridiculous. And not a good one from you, Mitt. Everyone misses sometimes. It's okay. But that's not a good one.
Do you think he possibly might have meant that these trials are redounding to Trump's benefit?
He did say that. Yeah. So he said, you know, that he felt like this was creating a win-win for Trump. But that is also, I'm sorry, that's also a silly notion. That is true in the primary. It is true with the Republican base, right? The more criminality for Trump, the higher he rose in the polls when it was in a primary. But we don't know what a conviction means in a general election. And I don't, Mitt Romney certainly doesn't either.
Right. Okay, thank you for that. All right, I want to note, because this happens periodically. It's an ongoing phenomenon. We've seen it very often on college campuses and other places where somebody makes a threat against someone they don't want to see perform or speak or whatever. And the reigning authorities say, well, we can't guarantee your safety, so we're going to have to cancel you. The most recent example involves artists. It's the Jerusalem String Quartet, which is a famous quartet that plays all over the world. They were scheduled to perform at the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. And the venue said they were very sorry, but because there had been threats of demonstrations and other kinds of violence, possible violence, that they were canceling the performance. And when the Concertgebouw made this announcement, there was a huge, very rapid effort by several very well-known musicians, including Joshua Bell and Alyssa Weilerstein, Danny Driver. They got together a petition that was signed by 7,000 artists who said, quote, "By canceling these concerts, the management of the Concertgebouw placates a vocal minority who advocate for their cause through intimidation and credible threats of disorder and violence. Anything less than permitting the Jerusalem Quartet to continue with its planned performances and to provide them and the audience with protection and support amounts to pure moral cowardice." So hooray for the musicians who stood up on their hind legs in this case and are staring down the bullies and intimidators. And I don't know yet what the final dispensation from the Concertgebouw is, but I hope they will do the right thing. And bravo to all of those musicians who circulated and signed that petition. And with that, I want to thank my one regular guest, my one regular panel member, my guests, Will Salatin, Chris Saliza, and of course, Sarah Longwell, and our wonderful viewers and listeners. I also want to mention our great producer, Jim Swift, our sound engineer, Jonathan Seary, and Beg to Differ will return next week, as every week.